Good morning. Anger over the election is long and deep. But did the work of political scientist Catherine Kramer 4 years ago forecast what media neglected to see? Contributing editor Neil Milner considers the politics of resentment. And on this week before Thanksgiving, weevils are making for a wobbly sweet potato crop. We'll talk with Susan Miyasaka, an agronomist at the College of Tropical Agriculture, about solutions. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkook. The Hawaii U Symphony, along with some of its most accomplished alumni, has some exciting performances coming up, including a Live from the Top radio broadcast. We'll talk with Executive Director Randy Wong.
It's November 16th, day one of our victory drive. We'll come back with a conversation right after this news. Good morning and welcome to the conversation. Hello, Chris.
Good morning, Beth.
We've got a lot of digesting to do of information that maybe if we had paid some attention to it a little while ago might have swayed how we looked at this last election.
Well, there's a lot about this country that those who comment on it didn't really see coming.
And we're going to talk about some of that this morning. Now, in 2007, University of Wisconsin political scientist Catherine Kramer began 5 years of conversations with people in small towns and rural areas in her state. Her purpose was to just listen to find out how people made sense of politics. She finished in 2012, 4 years before this year's presidential election, and what she found out was what many in American mainstream media missed, how little we really understand about a key group of voters that led to Donald Trump's victory. Contributing editor Neil Milner is back to consider Kramer's work and what she calls the politics of resentment. Good morning.
Morning.
You know, we talked yesterday with Joshua Benton of the Nieman Journalism Lab at Harvard University about how so much of online media has migrated to the coasts and what that means for journalists actually writing about places where, you know, they know, or places that they know intimately, where they've put their feet on the ground and spent some real time walking around, not just, you know, strategically parachuting in and then out again. Her work seems to be the absolute antithesis of that, where she spent so much time, 5 years, in rural areas that are so different. As you look at her work, and she talks about, you know, the rise of Scott Walker and all this, so many clear parallels to Donald Trump that we simply didn't take into consideration. Why?
Well, let's start with what I call the power of listening, because she makes it very clear that what she set out to do was to listen. And that's a clear signal about how you're going to do this research. It's much more intense and ongoing than just parachuting in and doing a story, even though there wasn't even enough of that kind of thing. What she was able to do was to continue to go to the same places over time, in gas stations, in coffee clutches, in little groups, and talk to people over time. And what that does is two things. You find out more in three things. You find out more information, you establish rapport, but it also means that you're, just by the nature of the work, it's much more anthropological, you're more likely to see these people as complex, full human beings, even if you disagree with a lot of them. So what she was able to do was to find out things that motivated them and how they thought about politics that was not only deeper than you can find out through polls or that you can find out through what the media person was talking about through social media, but also makes you reframe, I think, how you think about voters that are very different and very much antithetical to you. And so she comes up with some very important and different kinds of ways to see these people and how they think.
How did she see them that were so incredibly different?
Well, there are two things that emerge that are important and that you really have to understand, and they're tied together. One is rural consciousness, and another is resentment. Rural consciousness is a filter that these people use to see the political world. Now, we've talked about filters before, like party identification and certain kind of social groups. They see much of the political world through the difference between what it means to be rural and the values of living in small town in rural Wisconsin and what the rest of the world was like. And that's the rural side. It leads them to a kind of resentment, to a sense of, it's not even a prejudice. It's a sense of saying these other people who live in cities, public employees, the University of Wisconsin, except for the football team and the marching band. All of these folks don't deserve what they're getting because they're not hard workers, because they don't appreciate what we do, and because they don't listen to us. Politicians, urban people don't listen to rural values. And that's the core. That's the core of how these people think. And if you start thinking about Trump voters, and remember, these are precisely the people that Hillary Clinton lost. These are people who supported Obama, more or less. They were a little bit reluctant at first, but he was the new guy. They saw him as change. And if you look at the voting statistics in these areas, it turned totally around from what Obama got to what Hillary got. So this idea is very important, and that's the main finding. That's the driver of everything else that she finds out about them.
Rural consciousness feeling very, very different from that which, you know, populates cities and all the rest of it. But the issue of racism, though, hasn't yet been addressed. How did she look at that?
She's very careful about that. She says that they don't talk in terms of race, that race might be there, but that it is tied up into many more broader considerations. Now, remember, Wisconsin is still a pretty white state, and this area is even whiter. So their direct experience is pretty limited with that, although direct experience and prejudice aren't always directly related. She says essentially that racism is not the driving force here. Yeah, one of the ways that people think about benefits is to associate them with race and then to back away. But she says this is deeper than that. This is not about just being racially prejudiced, but it's more important to understand how their values are really different. Now, you see what's starting to happen here. People who don't like this kind of approach, that don't like how these people vote, are probably going to never be convinced that race isn't at the bottom of this. And I think all she's saying is it's not at the bottom of this, that there's something else driving it.
Right. I mean, your point that people will see in it what they want to see in it. But the fundamental difference in what happened with her research over 5 years and what we saw reflected in a lot of the media that followed the election for not just, you know, this past couple of months, but all throughout the cycle, which is the better part of 2 years, is that there was a whole group that just failed to get their message out there or through the media, or that was actually listened to, that word of listening and going back and being mindful and seeing the complexity of people and who was willing to listen to all groups and not just pay lip service to that. Is that the enduring lesson from this?
Well, it's certainly one of the enduring lessons that Donald Trump often would talk about the fact that there are a group of people who aren't listened to. Now, remember, this is not about some kind of objective measure about how much people were listened to. This is letting people talk through their own perceptions of their own world. You always have to keep that in mind. We're not making judgments here of how objectively right they are. But
no,
hey,
but just how much they were represented in the overall narrative and dialogue that we heard.
Well, that's right, how much they thought they were. And I think what happens, and this polls do this because it's hard not to do it, it turns out that the categories that we use to think about these people tend to be pretty limited. It's because that's how polls, it's race, it's gender, it's all of these sorts of things. Because polls don't have, unless you could do a long thing over time, they can't really tap into these things in depth. But it's certainly clear, two things are clear, one of which is that not being listened to and not appreciating our values is very powerful, and that politicians, especially on the right, are able to manipulate that argument into a broader argument of traditional conservatism. And it's not. That's the one final point I want to make. It's a very different position here to say, I don't like government because they don't know how to use the money and because we never get a share, rather than saying a kind of big government, you know, a small government conservative. So, and Donald Trump is much closer to that older one.
Neil, we got to go. But
yeah.
Thanks very much for bringing us out. I mean, it's amazing that...
Read the book. It's great. It's an easy read.
The book is The Politics of Resentment, Rural Consciousness in Wisconsin and the Rise of Scott Walker. Lots of parallels to this last presidential election. And the political scientist who wrote it was Catherine Kramer.
are back with the conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. This is an exciting time of the year for the Hawaii Youth Symphony, the island's only statewide instrumental music education program. Its orchestra, more than 100 strong, will perform live on From the Top, and some of its principals will get an opportunity to reveal their individual talents. With that and its annual winter concert that same weekend, Executive Director Randy Wong is being kept busy, and we talked with him about the performances coming up at the end of the month.
On Hawaii Island, we have one former student, William Sa. He's a cellist. And then on Oahu, December 4, we have 100 students from Youth Symphony 1.
An ensemble with 100 students in it, and that's your job to sort of pull that together. What does that call for in you?
Well, it calls for very little in me. I'm not the one that pulls them together. It's, you know, the work is really, it's by and large, our esteemed maestro and music director, Henry Miyamura, who is the orchestra's conductor.
Mm-hmm.
And then a very dedicated team of parent volunteers. Les Murata, who's been volunteering for 30-plus years, is our kind of our VP of operations and stage managing. And then two concert parents, Lance Uchida and Laura Yamamoto, who, you know, they attend the rehearsals every week, and you know, they help to keep the kids in line. Not that they really need, you know, anything to keep them in line, but, you know, they take attendance and they facilitate the music distribution and all those sorts of things. And then, of course, dozens and dozens of parents who are just totally dedicated to their kids' music education. So signing them up for private lessons, having them be part of our great, you know, schools, band and orchestra programs and so forth.
These days in music education, Randy, a lot of the motivation has to come from outside the schools just as an economic necessity, doesn't it?
That's true. The funding, you know, funding in the arts, it seems particularly in Hawaii, is, you know, it's at a dangerous precipice. So it's tricky because we really want to support, you know, all kinds of programs for youth. But, you know, music education, you know, Chris, as you know, makes a very impactful difference in the lives of the kids that we're able to reach to.
And you see that. I mean, you yourself are a beneficiary, right, as a former member. And
Yeah, you know, I'm the Youth Symphony's first alumnus who served as executive director. My parents signed me up for a string orchestra back in third grade, and I continued with the Youth Symphony program year after year, you know, doing the summer programs also, and made it all the way up to the top orchestra, and just then decided that a life in music and a life in the arts was for me, and that's what I've, you know, dedicated myself to.
How long did it take you to reach that point?
Determining that arts,
yeah,
the life in the arts was for me. I don't think it actually took that long. I think the just having positive experiences, positive role models, and you know, being around a lot of great musicians. You always, as a kid, you're always looking for the next great opportunity, and if you're passionate about music, then there's all sorts of, you know, things that the world is open to.
You've also seen the participation in the Youth Symphony have its effect on many of your peers,
mm-hmm.
and you see it ongoing, right?
Absolutely. We, you know, sometimes people ask us if a goal of the Youth Symphony is to train students to become professional musicians, and that's not one of our stated goals, but I think, you know, deep arts learning has so many qualities that, you know, transfer into the workforce. And so, you know, all of our students are out there contributing to the community in some way, be it through business, medicine, legal, real estate, education. You know, a lot of them have gone to become public school teachers, and they serve on, we have alums that serve on boards both for the Youth Symphony and for other organizations, and you know, they're involved as vibrant, you know, citizens.
Well, Randy, you know, let's say somebody who goes into a profession completely away from music, you know, an attorney, a doctor, mm-hmm. something like that. What do they tell you about what being in the Youth Symphony did for them?
You know, the first thing I always hear about is work ethic and dedication and commitment to you know, to personal passion. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's practice. It's getting into the culture of practice and to continuous improvement. And, you know, I think there's something about, you know, being a musician where you're always appreciative. You're appreciative of things going around you. So it's like a kind of a positivity and optimism. Of course, you learn to multitask. You improve your listening comprehension. You have a great sense for, you know, kind of prioritization, what's going on directly, you know, in yourself. So individually, you know, reading music and learning the notes and fingerings and bowings and articulations and so forth, but then how to put that into the context of those who are doing the same as you, so maybe within your section, and then the context of the larger orchestra, so how your piece fits in with everybody else. You know, how do you communicate these ideas non-verbally, you know, through gesture, behavior, and then working under the largest construct, which is the entire orchestra, and, you know, getting that direction from your conductor and concertmaster and putting it all together.
One of the things about music that I think is most encouraging is that you learn pretty early on that if you practice, you will be rewarded, right? There's a pretty direct relationship, and it's really the only way to get better. But if you have a kind of a disciplined approach, chances are you're going to get results.
I think that's true. And the other thing that practice teaches us is that rewards and accomplishments don't come right away.
Yeah.
You know, that you really have to stay the course. You have to be disciplined. Practice, I think, for most classical musicians, certainly for myself, to me, it kind of reveals that you're not continually going up. Sometimes, you know, you kind of go up and then you plateau and then feels like you go down for a little bit, and then you're wondering, well, what am I doing? But you stay the course, and eventually, that line, that trajectory, kind of, it does. There is a positive increase, but it could be months, if not years, before you really see it manifest itself. And I think that's a great allegory for, you know, a lot of things that we encounter in everyday life.
Randy Wong is the executive director of the Hawaii Youth Symphony, which will perform live on Hawaii Public Radio's From the Top on Friday, December 2nd, and the symphony's annual winter concert is the following Sunday, December 4th, at 4 p.m. at the Blaisdell Concert Hall.
Aloha, I'm Tammy Colucci from Diamond Head Theater. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2.
Unihua, ulehua, unihau, ukaua, uahu, umulokai, ulanai, umau, ukahoolabe, uhangai.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're remembering a 19th century British ship that played an important role in Hawaiian history. It was a 46-gun frigate under the command of one Lord George Anson Byron, a cousin to the great poet adventurer we think of as the Lord Byron. The ship came to Honolulu in 1824 on a sad errand, and flags were at half-mast when it came into the harbor. It carried the bodies of King Kamehameha II and Queen Kamamalu, who had died of measles on a trip to England. Once the crew arrived in what were then called the Sandwich Islands, the specialists on board made the most of their opportunities. The survey team became the first to identify and record the ancient Hawaiian trails that became known as the 1825 Malden Trails. It also recorded a variety of flora and fauna previously unknown to Europeans. Robert Dampier, the ship's artist, made several notable paintings, including one of the ship that hangs in Washington Place. And there's your clue. This morning, we're looking for the ship's name. We'll be back with it in half an hour. In 2013, a bill to ensure safe sleep practices at Hawaii daycare centers promised new rules. So how come babies are still dying? Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair is in our studio this morning with a reality check. Good to see you actually across the table.
It is.
To have you here.
I wish it was a more...
to talk about this. It's just
less heartbreaking a topic.
You look at this and wonder what happened. What happened to these rules that were promised and seem not to be there?
That's
what
right.
did happen?
Well, I should put a little context here. Our reporter, John Hill, as we've reported here on The Conversation, reported on a four-month-old baby who died under mysterious circumstances at a Honolulu daycare center. There was also a six-month-old that died at an Eva Beach daycare center. This is something that happens a lot, 64 deaths of babies over the last 5 or 6 years. So the call for this law. We're one of only seven states that don't have some sort of law in place to make sure that infants don't suffocate in their cribs in agencies that are regulated by the state.
Well, in their cribs are just saying exactly how the baby should be put down to sleep.
Exactly. To be on their back. We're talking in part about sudden infant death syndrome, what everybody knows about. So Brickwood Gulatari, the state senator, pushed for this to happen. And you're right. It was 3 years ago. And we're actually looking at probably 4 to 4.5 years, meaning 2017, from the time that it was passed to actually implementing the rules. And that's the frustration that the Department of Human Services has not moved faster to get these things on the books.
There have been guidelines and discussions about that, and sort of a, if I remember this bill correctly, sort of a watering down or diluting of how this was going to be done and who was going to be responsible for it. Did that cause the big problem? I mean, certainly for parents who say, look, if those rules had been in place, if people had been taught appropriately, if there had been the kind of training that there should have been, the children that we've lost in the last few years would still be alive.
And we want to be careful about not saying, but because these rules weren't in place, that
but
these
for,
deaths,
right, but for but a it, parent who are saying oh, that kind of yeah. thing or saying just, you know, why or looking for some reason like this woman that you
sure.
talked about, who is still saying, you know, my child died under mysterious circumstances.
And that's what John has talked about. We can tell you the DHS opposed making this a law. They said, let us handle it through administrative rules. The lawmaker said, okay, that's fine. Suzanne Chun-Uckland, who's now leaving the Senate, said it can take time. They got a heavy workload at DHS. But that is the concern, that they're not implementing this and potentially saving lives. There are rules in place to make sure that babies are in a crib or on a cot or a mat or a rug when that's needed, but they are silent on whether babies are sleeping on the backs. And that's exactly what we're getting at here. And remember, we regulate these daycare centers. Parents trust that their children will be taken care of when they have to go off to work.
That's the point. So where does this leave us now as we're getting ready for another legislative session?
Well, I know John will be staying on this. It's possible lawmakers will revisit it. But as Brickwood Gulatari said, look, this is not rocket science.
Yeah.
This is rules. Let's get this together. And we believe that he will be making sure that this happens. I can tell you that our reporter, John Hill, will still very much stay on this beat and keep us up to date on where those rules are.
And we'll talk more as we know more. Thanks very much, Chad, and nice to have you in the studio.
Thanks, Bethann.
Chad Blair joins us every day from Civil Beat, usually from Civil Beat's office. And nice to have you here today with a reality check.
In today's backyard quiz, we remembered a British naval vessel, a 46-gun frigate, that brought the bodies of King Kamehameha II and Queen Kamamalu back to the island from England. Both had died of measles on a ceremonial visit to England in 1824. The ship's commander, Lord George Anson Byron, came to the islands with a ship's artist, a survey team, and naturalists aboard. All would make contributions to Europe's knowledge of the islands through land surveys, data gathering about indigenous wildlife, and paintings by the ship's artist, Robert Dampier. Captain Lord Byron, who attended a meeting of island chiefs in June of 1825, is credited with introducing the trial by jury method to the kingdom. He also created Hawaii's first magic lantern show using a projector and slides he had brought along for the voyage. The captain wrote a book about the voyage called Voyage of HMS Blonde to the Sandwich Islands, 1824 and 25. And that's the name we were looking for, HMS Blonde. And nobody got that today. But if you've got a quiz you'd like to share about our island backyard, you can send it to us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Thanksgiving is a week away, and on many tables, a legacy dish will make an appearance, but the key ingredients may have to come from elsewhere. Hawaii Island sweet potatoes have been under siege. A small nocturnal insect is causing some farmers to abandon their crops. Meanwhile, the University of Hawaii College of Tropical Agriculture is looking for answers to what varieties may be more hardy as they face the rough sweet potato weevil. Susan Miyasaka is an agronomist with the College of Ag, and she's on the phone with us now from Hilo. Good morning.
Good morning, Bethann.
First of all, a lot of people confuse yams with sweet potatoes, so let's disabuse them of that really quickly. When we talk about sweet potatoes, we're talking about that root vegetable that has the tapers at both ends, right?
Right. It is in the morning glory family.
And not really related to yams at all.
No, they're totally different species and genera.
So when we're talking about what people may go looking for that would be perhaps locally grown sweet potatoes, are they going to have a real problem this year?
Well, hopefully not. I think that we're starting to get this problem under control. When we first discovered it on the Big Island in 2014, I was conducting sweet potato variety trials. And we had no idea originally what caused, you know, sort of these grooves or channels on the external surfaces of the storage roots. And Brian Bush from the University of Hawaii's Agricultural Diagnostic Service Center was the first one to tell me, oh, he thought that it was due to rough sweet potato weevil. And he showed me pictures of the damage on sweet potatoes. And I said, that is it. And after that, I contacted Dr. Grant McQuate, and Dr. McQuate came out to my fields in Pepekeo, where I was conducting the experiments on varieties of sweet potatoes, and he was able to trap and identify that, yes, these were rough sweet potato weevils. And so that was the first report of rough sweet potato weevils on the Big Island.
Do you have any idea, Susan Miyasaka, how this weevil got to Hawaii? I mean, we always talk about invasive species and being very careful, but this one seems to be rather a mystery.
Well, it first arrived in 2008 onto the island of Oahu, and I'm not sure how it got there because this pest is found in the Philippines and Asia, so I'm not quite sure how it got here. According to Dr. Grant McQuate, the sweet potato weevil doesn't fly very readily. It's a nocturnal insect. So, you know, the way that farmers have been accidentally moving it is when they plant cuttings of sweet potatoes, you know, they're transporting the eggs and possibly adults along with their cuttings when they plant them. And according to Dr. Grant McQuate, they don't fly very well. The adults don't fly very well. So people are accidentally transporting it with the leaves, not likely with the storage roots, but definitely with the leaves.
So any idea of how it migrated from Oahu in what, 2008, to other islands, including especially the Big Island?
It was probably transported, you know, in these cuttings of sweet potato, because that's how we plant sweet potato.
So as they moved inter-island with those cuttings, they just brought the weevils right along with them. So what do we do now? I mean, I've heard that some farmers are just saying, well, you know, enough already, and they're not going to go and try to fight them, and they're just going to let it peter out.
Well, the worst thing that they could do is to abandon their fields, because when they do that, then the rough sweet potato weevils just multiply in that field. So that is the absolute worst thing that farmers could do. But as I said, we're starting to get a hold on how to control rough sweet potato weevils. So obviously the first one is you don't move the larvae, or you don't move the insects or the adults when you plant your new cuttings. And so you have to be really careful, you know, that you don't accidentally move this invasive pest.
And
I do have an experiment where I'm looking at different varieties to see if there are differences in resistance to rough sweet potato weevil. And there does seem to be indication that there are differences between varieties. But the most commonly grown variety, Okinawan, sort of has a moderate resistance to rough sweet potato weevil.
That seems to be reasonably good news, that it's not so incredibly vulnerable to it. But there are so many varieties of sweet potato. As you say, you've been doing some trials with them. Anything that's emerging that you think might show up in our grocery stores in the next, you know, 5 years or so?
You mean different varieties?
Right, different varieties that might be able to withstand this in a much better way than we've seen even the Okinawan sweet potato, which, as you said, has sort of a moderate resistance to it. And that, you know, asking people not to propagate cuttings and to do what they can do to get rid of the weevil, but to bring in something else that might be more hardy.
Well, that is part of a grant that I have right now from the County of Hawaii Department of Research and Development. So they're funding me to bring in some accessions from the USDA Germplasm Repository in Griffin, Georgia. And these have been reported to have resistance to the regular sweet potato weevil. And so I want to test whether they have resistance to the rough sweet potato weevil. But this is a long process. You know, right now, Okinawan is the major sweet potato variety that is grown on the Big Island, partly for local consumption and partly for transport and export to the U.S. mainland. And so in order to have a resistant Okinawan sweet potato, that would involve breeding, and that is a long-term process.
So you're really looking at, what, somewhere 5 years out, maybe 10 years out?
Sure, that sounds reasonable.
And meanwhile, when you say that, you know, farmers should not simply just let this go and abandon their crops, what are you telling them to do?
Well, basically what they should do is harvest all their sweet potatoes, even if they are unmarketable, and then to destroy them, or else they could deep plow them under, you know, so that the insects would not be able to multiply underground. And right now, I have gotten anecdotal reports that there is a biopesticide, Bovaria bassiana, which is used to control coffee berry borer, and we are looking into whether this biopesticide could be used to control rough sweet potato weevil.
Well, Dr. Miyasaka, thank you so much for joining us, and we hope that there will be great success. Those of us who like vegetables depend upon it.
All right. Thank you,
thank
Bethan.
You. Susan Miyasaka is a researcher at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. Now she's stationed at the Komohana Agriculture Research and Extension Center in Hilo. Her focus areas are alternative crops and cropping systems, plant nutrition, and tropical root crops, including sweet potato. Well, we've talked a lot about perhaps having some better sweet potatoes coming out of Hawaii. We're going to hope that we've got a few more clams coming into Hawaii Public Radio now as we're into the first day of our 35th anniversary victory drive.
I was wondering how you're going to make that transition. That's pretty good, actually.
Little faith, you.
Yeah.
But seriously, there's a lot of excitement. And when you think about 35 years and what that means,
right,
and going forward and where we will be 35 years hence, with all the help from people who are making their pledges today. So we're going to send it back to Pledge Central and to you, Ray Cruz.
Thanks, Beth Ann. Great transition from clams to sweet potato. Love it. Only on The Conversation. Good morning, everyone, on this Wednesday morning, day one of our victory drive. That was great. Here's what's happening if you're just tuning in on this Wednesday morning. We're celebrating, as you just heard Beth Ann say, 35 years, our 35th anniversary. It was just this past weekend. Very happy times, very proud times for us here at Hawaii Public Radio. A lot of heavy lifting has been done by all of you, the members. We have plenty of listeners, but it's our members who do the heavy lifting. And if you haven't had your opportunity to get on board and help us get to another 35 years, now's the time. 941-3689, 941-3689, toll free 1-877-941-3689. I'll tell you what, we are going back to Hilo, to the Lyman Museum and Mission House in downtown Hilo. And we're going back there, and we're going to speak to Jose Fajardo in Hilo because we can now. We can talk to Hilo direct. Take it over, Jose.
Ray, I love the way you say my name, by the way, with that nice Boricua accent. We are broadcasting live from the Lyman Museum and Mission House in downtown Hilo. We're not just celebrating our 35 years of providing Hawaii Public Radio, but we're also celebrating the fact that we have concluded, have wrapped up our statewide initiative by adding HPR2 to the east side of the Big Island. HPR2 now being broadcast on 91.3. So this morning, we're not just saying aloha to previous listeners throughout the islands of Hawaii, but also aloha to new listeners on HPR2 on 91.3. We're taking 2 days to celebrate our victory drive here at Hawaii Public Radio, inviting you, the listener, to help us make possible the next 35 years by calling 941-3689, 941-3689. Perhaps you, if you're trying us out for the very first time, try us out at $3.50 a month. Try us out at perhaps 35 cents a day. Try us out with a one-time contribution of $35. You kind of get the hint. We're driving the $35 contribution here in support of 35 years of service of Hawaii Public Radio. 941-3689. And joining me here at the studios are short-term, temporary, one-day studios at the Lyman Museum and Mission House in downtown Hilo is Barbara Hastings with Hastings and Pleadwell, an HPR board member, program underwriting, and sustaining member since 1994. Barbara, we're here.
Hey, and I need to call out to all of those people in East Hawaii who for years have been saying, I'll become a member when you have HPR2 coming to us. And it's here now, and we are able to listen to these great programs here in East Hawaii. And so please get on the phone, 941-3689. Get on the phone, particularly new members. We want to hear from you.
You know, Barbara, Ray mentioned the number of listeners that we have compared to the number of members that we have. We have about 196 listeners who tune in to both HPR1 and HPR2 combined, and about 13,000 of those are members supporting Hawaii Public Radio. I think we started off with a budget in 1981, I think I heard Rosemary say earlier today, of $7,000, and now we have a budget of $5.3 million. We started in 1981 with one transmitter, and now we have 15 collective transmitters, translators, and repeaters, because that's how we get the signal from Honolulu all the way to all the islands of Hawaii. We're here to support Hawaii Public Radio. We're asking you to call now at 941-3689 or online at hawaiipublicradio.org. So, Barbara, you've been listening now more to HPR2. Anything, any program that's popped out as something you enjoy listening to?
Well, I'm particularly taken with being able to pick up the conversation. We heard for so many years, you know, follow us on HPR2, the conversation, and we weren't able to. So that's been wonderful. But also the international news, the exposure to the BBC, and getting that global perspective, particularly right now, and their view of us.
Yes, and you can help make that possible by calling 941-3689 or at hawaiipublicradio.org. Back to our friends on Kaheka Street in Honolulu, Ray Cruz and Wayne, Beth Ann and Chris, back to you guys.
Thanks, Jose, and we are indeed back here at Hawaii Public Radio. And Wayne Yoshioka, we're quickly approaching the 9 o'clock hour. Any final thoughts here for our listeners today?
Really support programs like The Conversation. You know, 25% of all the programming here, locally produced, we need your support. 941 3689.
And Jeanette Cojane, she's still here with us. And I'm sorry we didn't get a chance to talk that much story this morning about what the excellent work that your organization does. But any closing thoughts here about our drive and what we're trying to accomplish?
You know, I would really encourage people to think about the sustaining member option. This is guilt-free. You don't have to worry, did I pay that, did I not? And you know that you're supporting the station. So this is a great day to become a sustaining member. So I'd really encourage people to do that. And, you know, there's one more thing off your busy to-do list. So
absolutely. Thank you so much for coming by, Jeanette. We really do appreciate it. And we have, speaking of that, we have a new sustaining member on the line right now as we speak from Kaneohe. You could be another one of those sustaining members by giving us a call at 941-3689, 941-3689, toll free 1-877-941-3689. Want to remind you that you're tuned to member-supported Hawaii Public Radio, KIPO Honolulu, KIPM Waikapu, KHBH Kailua Kona, KIPH Hana, KIPO Lihue, and KAHU Pahala, collectively the stations of HPR2. Stay with us. We're going off to the news from NPR for world and national headlines, and then be back with the takeaway here on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Again, the numbers are 941-3689, 941-3689, toll-free 1-877-941-3689, and you can pledge online at hawaiipublicradio.org.